Jerry Schilling was a poor 12-year-old kid in North Memphis when he first met Elvis Presley, then a 19-year-old truck driver who was just beginning the singing career that would make him an American music legend. Schilling became friends with Elvis and eventually joined the crew known as the Memphis Mafia that traveled with Elvis through years of concerts, movie shoots, and recording sessions, and plenty of downtime in Hollywood, at Graceland, and at movie theaters and amusement parks that Elvis would rent for get-togethers. Now, 29 years after Elvis's death, Schilling has written a memoir of their friendship. He describes an Elvis who was a voracious reader and a spiritual seeker, a man who was both temperamental and extravagantly generous with his friends, and a performer who was artistically frustrated. His book is called Me and a Guy Named Elvis, My Lifelong Friendship with Elvis Presley. Before we get to our conversation with Schilling, let's hear Elvis's first hit, That's All Right.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. It's all right, Mama, any way do. Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that guy you foolin' with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right, that's all right. That's all right, Mama, any way do.
Your relationship with Elvis began in the most ordinary of ways. When I first read this in the notes, I couldn't believe this could actually be true, but you really did meet him playing touch football, right?
Yeah, in North Memphis, our local playground, I was kind of a lonely kid, just not even a teenager. I was 12 years old. And I went to the park one Sunday afternoon, and there were five older guys trying to get up a football game. This is how unpopular Elvis Presley was in July of 1954. And one of the older boys, who was a friend of my older brother's, said, Jerry, you want to play with us? And I said, sure. And I went in the huddle, and the other player was Elvis Presley, a 19-year-old who had just recorded his record, had been played locally two nights before on Dewey Phillips' Red Hot and Blue show in Memphis. And when I looked at this guy, I went, oh, that's the guy I heard on the radio the night before last.
What was the record?
That's Right, Mama. That was the, he had recorded it that week, I think around the first part of the week. And this was a Sunday afternoon. I had heard the record Friday, Saturday night, or Thursday, Friday night. And it was 7-11, July 11th, 1954. When I met Elvis and we played touch football.
So you met Elvis on the football field. He was the quarterback in the huddle. Did you have any particular impression of him? You obviously were a starstruck kid and fascinated by the fact that he'd made this great record. Did he have any particular presence as a quarterback?
Well, you know, he was, he had a presence that was approachable and unapproachable at the same time. Something like a presence that when people develop as a star, you kind of get that thing, you know, where they're, you know, you hope they like you, but you're not sure. Elvis had that before he was a star. He was just, I kind of think of him as this lovable rebel, if you will. He wasn't somebody I was going to run up and slap on the back as a buddy. And yet, you know, he also, there was a kind of friendliness that showed through and then an edginess on the other side.
It was fascinating to read the description of your book, how as his popularity grew, he continued to show up on Sundays and play touch football. And people began to come and watch because they heard this hot young guy, Elvis Presley, was out here playing touch football. And he was controversial at the time because, you know, he touched some hot buttons. Some people didn't like some of the stuff that was in his music. And you tell a fascinating story of some semi-pro football players who come up and want to mess with Elvis. Tell us that story.
We were playing, we were probably into about our first year, still playing at the same little park in North Memphis. Elvis was a creature of habit. We played every Sunday he was home, and these two big semi-pro guys came over to play. And, you know, everybody kind of stood back a little bit, and Elvis said, yeah, sure, you guys can play. And so we got into the huddle, we came out, and Elvis would switch from quarterback from time to time, and he was on the line. And this guy just ran right over him. We were all like, you know, come on. I mean, the guy's, you know, he's got a recording career. We're thinking to ourselves. So Red West, one of the other guys with us, tough guy, the guy that called me over to play football that first day, he said, Elvis, I'll take him this time. And Elvis said, no, just go on and play your position, Red. He got run over again. And finally, about the third time, Elvis said something to the effect, you want to try the other side? And the guy said, what do you mean? He said, well, all my bones are broken in this side. And the guy started laughing. And they realized that Elvis wasn't some guy who was going to, you know, try to be something special or whatever. He'd get down nose to nose with you. So these two guys who had given us so much trouble, I mean, we're ready to fight him, and Elvis kind of knew what he had to do.
Eventually, he hires you to come and work for him, and it's a fascinating moment. By this point, you're a little older. You've finished high school, I believe, and had done some college, and he says, I want you to come work for me. And I guess it was the first day or two that they're packing up to from Graceland to head out to California to make Elvis's next movie, and the traveling arrangements I found fascinating. Describe how Elvis traveled to California to film.
Well, first of all, you know, Elvis never was a cross-country truck driver. He drove a little panel truck in Memphis at an electrician company that he worked for. But boy, when it was time to travel to California, we had this Dodge mobile home, and Elvis drove every mile of it. He would, you know, he put his driver's gloves on. He had this scarf on and kind of this motorcycle hat that, if you will, kind of like out of the Wild Ones of Brando. He would have a reel-to-reel tape player with whatever music he was into at the time. And I loved those trips. And this first trip, there was one thing. I had known Elvis for 10 years prior to going to work for him in 1964, which was my senior year in college. And I was just getting ready to be a history teacher, and I was to practice teach when he asked me to go to work for him. And that one trip from Memphis to Los Angeles, which took us about 9 or 10 days, we stopped at truck stops and played football. We were in hotel rooms talking all night. But I got to know Elvis more in that 1 week and a half than the 10 years I had known him before.
It was also in those trips that you realized he was taking pills and the rest of you started taking them too, right? What kinds of drugs were going on then?
Well, you know, I was considered the health fanatic of the group. They used to call me Mr. Milk because I was playing college football and I was working out all the time. And as we took these all-night trips across country, I think to stay awake for Elvis, something that he had picked up in the army over in Germany, Dexedrine pills would keep you awake, and you know you could play some pretty damn good football games with that as well. And then you know, so somebody slipped me one once, and I tried it, and I think I was going out for passes for about 3 days. And then you get to a point where you can't sleep, and then you get a sleeping pill. And that's basically what it was in that period. We would take Dexedrine to keep going because Elvis never wanted to quit, especially when he was having a good time, whether it was on the road playing football or if we were in Vegas. He'd want to go to show, and, you know, you can go 24 hours. Sometimes we'd stay up 2 or 3 days. And then you crash, and then you sleep for 2 or 3 days. It's not anything I would recommend to anybody. But You know, it was before we knew a lot, and it was prescribed medication from our doctors. And, you know, I looked at it like this. Hey, this guy's the best-looking guy I've ever seen. He's the most talented guy. He's fun to be around. It's got to be good for you.
You describe a lot of time hanging out in Los Angeles, in Graceland, before after shows. Mostly guys hanging out. Must have been a lot of women in Elvis's life. I mean, certainly stories of that. Where do they fit into the picture?
Well, normally when we hung out, there was women there with us. If not our girlfriends, and later on our wives and whatever. But even when we were by ourselves coming out to Los Angeles to do movies, there was a group of girls that were really friends, not dates, that Elvis enjoyed their company. They were included a lot, and then, of course, the people that we were dating. But there were a lot of girls, trust me.
Was Elvis a philanderer? Did he fool around?
You know, Elvis basically was a one-on-one guy in a relationship in general. And then you take that, and he was Elvis Presley. Yeah, of course. I mean, if his girlfriend was living in Memphis and we were on the West Coast, he would have a girlfriend here. He was Elvis Presley. I mean, it was very tempting. I mean, I can't just blame him. We were all that way to a certain degree. I just think if I had been Elvis Presley in his shoes, I would have probably even had more girlfriends. Just he liked to have relationships, you know?
Relatively restrained given the opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, you grow a lot after you get out of high school. I mean, that's a time, I think, in people's lives when they undergo a lot of change, whether, you know, you're going to college and stretching your mind or entering the working world and, you know, understanding what that requires, living as an adult. And here you have Elvis Presley, who immediately after high school becomes incredibly rich, incredibly famous, and inevitably then surrounded by relationships of inequality, even with friends like you. You know, there's also an employer-employee relationship, and he's in a situation where he can indulge, you know, any annoyance or grudge. He never has to kind of humble himself and take the guff that most people do. And he grows up this way in his 20s. And I'm wondering if you've ever thought what the effect was on Elvis's personality of sort of at such a young age to be so kind of entitled to indulge his moods.
You know, I have thought about that a lot, even when I was with him, and I've thought about it since. You mature real fast. What happens when you're in that position? You're the center of attraction, not just when you're on stage or in front of a camera, when you wake up in the morning. Everybody else is your friend, they're your employee, and their whole life centers on your mood that day. And Elvis handled that pretty damn well. I never felt when I lived at Graceland and worked with Elvis, I never felt that I wasn't a part of it. Push come to shove, every great once in a while when he'd be upset, you know, you realized, okay, I work for this guy and this is how it's going to be. But on a day-to-day basis, we truly lived as brothers. And that was because he understood. He wanted, first of all, he was a loner as a kid. When you move at 12 years old, 13 years old, from one state like Mississippi, and he was in rural poverty, Mississippi, and he moved to our neighborhood, which was poor North Memphis. If you look at Hustle and Flow, that's where it was filmed, right there in our neighborhood. Same houses and everything, still there. And so Elvis's dream, like a lot of lonely kids, was to have friends and to share things with. And Elvis got that pretty good. I think it was harder for the people, the family, the uncles and whatever, and aunts and cousins and us guys to get used to living that kind of life and accepting that. I mean, some of the guys didn't make it. Some of the family didn't make it.
What do you mean by didn't make it, Jerry?
I think, well, there was a couple of the cousins right in the early days that went off the deep end, took too many pills, died at early 20s. It blew a lot of people's minds who were close to Elvis, what happened to Elvis. Elvis was a pretty constant force. When you're in that position, too, you have a tremendous amount of power. You can look at somebody wrong and really, really do some damage. And Elvis never abused that. He didn't abuse that power. He understood, you know, what he had. When you did see, at times he was a human being, and at times with us that knew him, he let it flow. I'd never seen a temper. I'd never seen a more angry guy in my life. So I've always said, one of the reasons why I love him even that much more, he just wasn't a good-looking guy with a good voice, the boy next door. He had all of those other traits, and he chose 90% of the time to be a nice guy.
Jerry Schilling, you know, one of the most important influences in Elvis's professional life was his relationship with Colonel Tom Parker, who's been criticized for, you know, manipulating him and making him do far too many shows, far too many records, and doing a lot of weak material. I mean, people sort of some blame him for sort of driving Elvis to an early grave. I mean, you saw that relationship a lot. What did you observe of Elvis? What was your sense of Elvis's relationship with Colonel Parker?
Overall, the Elvis Presley Colonel Parker relationship was a very successful, very special relationship. I think there was a period where Elvis outgrew the Colonel, mostly in creativity. I think, as great as Elvis's career was, I think the people in charge always looked at him as a short-term artist. They thought maybe long-term, but Elvis always knew. I mean, he was a genius at what the public wanted, and he knew if the movies were the same thing, you know, with different songs and different locations, that people would get tired of it. He predicted it way before it happened. And he was a genius that needed creative challenges. And he would come up with them himself from time to time. And then it was, you know, whether it was the studios or record companies or whatever, they didn't want to pay. They paid top dollar for Elvis Presley. And they didn't really want to pay top dollar for co-stars, for scripts. And Elvis creatively suffered from that. And there's a theme that goes through my book that I really think we lost Elvis on creative disappointment. The drugs were the Band-Aid, but I go back to the cause of and I put specific examples, and I was in meetings, and I was in between Elvis and the Colonel about overseas touring. I observed a heavyweight meeting when Elvis would not do this movie because the script was so lame. I was in a walk-in dressing room closet when Barbra Streisand offered Elvis A Star Is Born, and I knew what that meant to him creatively. I think the Colonel truly had a love and respect for Elvis. I just think at a point it was too old school. He probably would have liked Elvis to be closer to Bing Crosby than the rock star that he was. You know, the Colonel is an easy target. He probably did most of the things right. And some of this stuff that you can't blame a guy for what they don't know. Colonel was not a creative genius. He was a business genius.
In Elvis's later years, when he was doing his Vegas act a lot, there are a lot of stories about him getting sloppy, forgetting or improvising lyrics and, you know, rambling monologues. How accurate is that picture? What did you observe?
You know, again, it goes to the creativity challenges. And unfortunately, there was a period in the last couple of years of Elvis's career where he was bored out of his mind playing the same room, all these shows, and he started kind of entertaining himself or working to one audience or whatever, and the shows really did suffer for it. One night, actually, about 300 people walked out. I never thought I'd ever see that. People walk out of an Elvis show.
What did he do that caused them to walk out?
I think he played to one table and started joking around. And this one table loved it, you know. They had the star of the show playing to them. We were all kind of panicked. He probably did four songs in the whole hour of his performance. And that's one of the nights where the Memphis Mafia afterwards, we all got together and confronted Elvis. And he kind of laughed at first, like, well, what do you mean that these people really enjoyed it? And Lamar, one of the guys with us, said, yeah, Elvis, but 300 people walked out. And then Elvis fired back at him, and I said, Elvis, of course the one table you played to is going to like it. And then he just kind of froze and said, call the colonel. That's how bad it got.
There was one episode where a man jumped up on a stage in 73, and Elvis becomes convinced that he was sent by a karate instructor that his former wife Priscilla had dated. And then his behavior just got more and more bizarre, right? What did he do?
Well, you know, this is a period where I think three major things was happening to Elvis. His health was getting bad. He didn't like the idea of being 40. He was going through a divorce, which he wanted and didn't want. And he was trying to keep his manhood up and his image up. And he put a lot of that into karate, even incorporating it on stage. And so one night, a couple of guys did jump on, actually four, but one guy jumped on stage and then another guy. And through all of this things that were happening to Elvis, he was convinced that Priscilla's boyfriend, Mike Stone, who was a really tough karate guy, he had never lost, had put this into motion. And we just couldn't convince him differently. After we found out, you know, the background on the people and everything.
And he started talking about having Mike Stone killed, right?
Yeah, it came, you know. There were calls made. It was ready to go, actually. And I think when Elvis realized he could do this, it scared him to death. And we were sitting at this table at dinner in Las Vegas, and I didn't hear the conversation. I knew what the conversation was. I was down the other end of the table. And I saw Elvis turn white and go, well, you know, I don't think we have to go that far. You know, let's forget about it for right now. He never mentioned anything like that again.
Well, Jerry Schilling, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Jerry Schilling. His book, Me and a Guy Named Elvis, comes out Wednesday on the 29th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death.